The KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and I'm joined in the studio by Craig Tucker of the KM Sports Desk. Our guest this week has coached at various levels of the game and even dabbled into management for a short time. He was part of the coaching setup under Jamie Day when Welling won the Conference South title in 2013, breaking the league record for consecutive wins along the way. He left the wings for the bright lights of Ebbsfleet United in December 2014, still working alongside Day, but the journey soon turned sour and they failed to see the season out at Stonebridge Road, despite a massive turnaround in players. He was back in the limelight when Welling made him their manager in January 2016, with the task of trying to keep them in the National League top flight. It was a task that proved too much, and he left when Mark Goldberg completed his takeover of the club just before the end of that season. There's plenty more than that to talk about, though, as we'll discover in the next hour or so. So it's a warm welcome to the studio to Dean Frost.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Thanks, Craig.
Good to see you, Dean. Yeah, thanks for coming in and joining us. Lots to talk about, I'm sure. Should we start with the highs of Welling? Let's go straight into that Conference South title winning season that I mentioned in the intro there. Still good memories for you?
Yeah, lots of good memories, yeah. I'm glad you're starting on the highs because there seemed to be quite a lot of lows at the end, Ebbsfleet and being sacked. The greatest period of like being involved in football that I've ever been part of. Yeah, I mean, it was a progress. We was out for 5 years and each year we progressed and saw an improvement in the team, improvement in where we finished, and then coming to the third or fourth year where we finally got promoted. It's great to be part of, and one of the best dressing rooms I've ever been involved in as a coach, manager, or a player. You know, it's a bit like a Sunday morning dressing room with a group of very, very good players, and I think that was a big part of why we've done so well, just the actual atmosphere in the dressing room.
Was that intentional?
I think Jamie Day, myself and Ash can set a bit of a tone, so we were quite laid back, relaxed, and we like to join in with the banter. But I think at Welling, you don't have the big money at some other clubs, so you sign players and get older players on whatever fit into your wage structure. Do a bit of homework and find out what the players are like. You might sign a player from another club and ring around, what's he like as a lad? So we did do a little bit of homework on players and find out whether they were, you know, we had a few, you know, what we call bad eggs or a few like quirky characters, but we try to get a dressing room full of like good honest players that liked a bit of, you know, could work hard, but they were good lads. And so, yeah, maybe a little bit we planned, but I think, you know, sometimes players just come together and it just works, you know what I mean? And, you know, we had some really good lads that once they got in that dressing room, I can't really remember ever having a really bad period of like sort of negativity or nastiness or, I don't know, cliques in the dressing room. Everyone was, you know, each year we was there, everyone was all one. So I think a little bit of credit goes to the management team, you know, because you could create that atmosphere, but once the lads go out or they're arranging nights out or golf days or fancy dress parties, whatever they're doing, that was down to them, and they created that atmosphere. And I think I'm pretty sure we got a lot more points as a consequence of having a real strong dressing room.
Who were the big characters for you in that time?
Joe Ealy's a great lad. Probably one of the best players I've seen at non-league level. At times, one of the worst as well. When he was bad, he was bad, but when generally he was very good. But I think someone like Joe, Lee Clark, Ben Martin, Blaine coming up for a season, he was mad as a march hare. I think everyone played their part. There were some nice lads that took a back seat, but they would get involved. I mean, Joe would always be out there on a night out, so I suppose he would. Fazza's, you know, a jack in the box. I see Fazza this weekend, so there was loads of them. Do you know what I mean? And they was all there for 3 or 4 years, so they helped whoever come into the dressing room. It was always a continuation. They, you know, whoever new player come in, they just come into that group straight away, and it carried on in the nights out or their days out or whatever they wanted to do to build a bit of rapport or a bit of team spirit and bonding. You know, there was loads.
How much coaching did they need? When you talk about the fun and the excitement or off the field, but how much work actually had to go into building a team that can win a league title?
Oh, good question. Well, you only get two nights a week. I think one night would always be made to be a bit fun. I think the big thing with non-league football, you're getting players to the session, so it had to be fun, but also maybe with an element of how we're going to set up or how we're going to play. But because we had quite a continuity, there wasn't always a big turnover of players. We pretty much had the same nucleus of six or seven, eight through that period. It was only different players that come in at different stages. They just, in the end, fitted into a system, and they've quickly... We did a little bit of coaching. I ain't going to lie. Now I play at manager, go, we used to go and watch a load of games and see what's your opposition. I've got to say, I did a bit of YouTube. I did quite a lot of YouTube stuff, but we didn't really go out and watch games. We just concentrated on us being good. I think at non-league level, sometimes the players dictate how you're going to play. Do you know what I mean? We can say we're going to play in a certain way, but at Welling, we couldn't go out and sign the right winger we wanted because we never had the money. So we had to go, right, we've heard so-and-so's been released, so he's going to fit in. And we've heard so-and-so at this club being released, he'd do us a favour and we could get him on the cheap. And so sometimes it all just fits in. You try and have a bit of a structure. We set up, we're trying to be organised and hard to beat. We've set ourselves up as set pieces for and against. But a lot of the time, sometimes I think actually Daisy playing in the middle of the park dictated how we played, you know, because he was instrumental. People forget that he was playing. So I think Daisy playing, I don't know, we did a lot of possession in training. It was a lot of possession stuff, a lot about when we do have to turn teams in behind. Maybe I'm doing us a bit of a disservice. We did do a bit of coaching, but I think it's the players that you bring in, actually it all falls into place, you know what I mean? Jacko Bastella and Joe on the left, it was a great partnership. You was there throughout their period, you know, they just worked well down the left hand side, and you go, well, we just left them get on with what they wanted to do, you know what I mean? And Clarkie and Jamie Day in midfield, Jamie sat in, let Clarkie go and bomb into the box to score goals. It just had good partnerships. It just, yeah, all come together.
What's the dynamic like when you mentioned Jamie was playing at the time as well, so when you've got a player manager, what's it like for the two coaches on the sidelines?
Oh, he had a go at us a few times for making substitutions at certain times. He'd give us a look as if say, "What? Yeah, what are you taking him off for?" Like, but in general, it was difficult with that Jamie because he's playing. So the dynamic when we first got together, I was sitting in at Corinthians waiting for Barry Ashby to turn up. I never met Barry Ashby in my life. And waiting for Jamie to turn up, or he may have been already there. But when we got our first introduction to Barry Ashby, I said, "Look, please tell me when I'm wrong." And he went, "No, same me. So please tell me when I'm wrong." So we had, straight away, we created an environment where we were all, and Jamie said the same as well. So he was just starting out. This was his first management job. So we all said, if we think we've said something wrong or something in our coaching or we could have done something better in the dressing room, let's just put it out there and just be honest with one another. So I think from that moment, we created it was no hiding, no treading on the eggshells. Oh, Ash said this, and we were just open with one another. So we created that. We had our own little team that we was honest with one another. I suppose the same way we were talking about good atmosphere with the players. We had we had a really open relationship. I think just at times, Jamie, every now and again, we might have made a substitution. Me and Ash and Daisy from the middle of pitches, pulling his face to say, "What are you doing?" But he knew we was doing it for what we thought was best, and remembering that Jamie's caught up in the game. So he's running at 100 miles an hour, involved in a game that's box-to-box, open. We feel the game's too open and we think, right, we need to tighten this game up, and we're making the decision. And after, we're talking to him and say, "Look, the game was so stretched, we need to make these decisions." And after it calmed down, he went, "Yeah, no, I can see your point." So we laid the foundations as soon as we met one another. I know I've been told off by Daisy a couple of times, but I always took it as an opportunity to improve. I mean, like, just go, yeah. I was always, as soon as I went into management or coaching, I always straight away, I always come home and reflected on a session, and there was more bad than good in the end, you know what I mean? So I didn't just hide and go, "Oh, God, everything was brilliant." A couple of times I think he might have said that, you didn't have to do that, or just an opportunity to improve. And that's why I say at the start, we was very open, be honest with one another, and we can hopefully all improve together.
So the year you won the title, the year before that was obviously the playoff final defeat at Dartford, and obviously that must have hurt a lot. When did you think that you could go one better the following season?
I think the year before, I think whoever lost the playoffs the year before actually went up, I think. So when we lost in the playoffs, I thought, maybe it's partly an omen and maybe hopefully people are really hurt. And that was quite tough. It was a very flat playoff, wasn't it? I don't know if you remember. It was went 1-0 down out about 7 minutes, and it was pretty flat. We couldn't get in. We felt a bit disappointed just not having a feel like we had a go to try and get in that playoff final. So disappointment. Maybe that disappointment fuels the players or us. We brought, to be honest, that pre-season, we went in as normal, just saying if we can improve a little bit, because Welling, we didn't have the biggest, you know, and I don't want to go on about wage, we didn't have the biggest wage budget. We couldn't really go and nail the players we thought we wanted because we didn't have the money. So, I mean, that was a funny pre-season. Ross Lafayette, who's now still playing conference football, or Conference South at the moment, but he's had a decent career for the last 6 years. He'd come to us as a trial. He'd been at Faz's solidarity camp in Spain, and Faz went, I've got a lad that might do like might help us out up front. We had no forward this season, I think. We had Ross Lafayette doing a pre-season, and it come to the last couple of training sessions. Daisy rang me up, went, what do you think of that Ross Lafayette lad? I said, he's done all right in pre-season. He said, but we've only got about 100 quid. He went, we've only got about 100 quid. He went, what do you reckon? And I went, we ain't got no one else. And he played the first four, I think he scored 4 in 4. We had to play him in the first game at home at Bath, and he scored. So in answer, I'm trying to create a picture that we were just signing players that was available or we thought we quite liked. And we were just probably just trying to get through the start of the season just to get a squad together, not thinking that we're going to go and win the league. And he goes and scores 4 in 4. And his career takes off. All of a sudden, he becomes a sort of bit of a non-league talisman. He's been a non-league talisman the last 6 years at different clubs. You know what I mean? Like a strong goal scorer at that level. So, we want to win the league, but we're realists and go, we've built a squad, but I don't know how far this is going to get us, but hopefully we've improved from the year before.
And what's it like winning the league title? Do you recall the celebrations?
It's a bit... I felt a bit flat. You're building up to we had a bit of a run in to get the points, and you anticipate, God, if we get these points and you're going to be high, and it's actually, I felt a bit flat because you had achieved it. I've read an article about Victoria Pendleton. I'm not Victoria Pendleton, I'm not some sort of super Olympian, but when she got bronze and silvers in tournaments or in competition, she always come home and knew what she needed to do for the next tournament. And she said when she finally got golds, she come home and felt flat and empty. And that's where I felt, I don't know what's the next. I suppose the next was just preparing for the season in the conference. But yeah, we had mental celebrations and whatever. So, they lasted. I think the boys went out, I think it lasted about 72 hours. I think they all ended up in Brick Lane and Bethnal Green, all over the place apparently.
One of the highlights, obviously, of that season when you won the league then was that league record of consecutive victories, 12 or 13 on the spin that you got. What triggered that? What was the what was the things behind that?
I don't think I think we just had a steady start. I think it was like maybe four or five wins, a couple of draws, I think it might have been a third loss, and we lost away to Maidenhead, and we was coasting. I think Kinchy got sent off, and then I think our performance collapsed a little bit, and we lost 2-1. And Daisy went absolutely mad. You know, I can't share the words that he used, but it was there was teas and coffees thrown around, the air dryer treatment, and he gave a few players the ultimatum. You know, if you're not buying into it, whatever, you can go. If you want to come and tell me, you can go. So the following week, we trained and whatever, and we went to Havant and Waterlooville, and we were down to bare bones. I think Jack Gallagher was a midfielder, but he had to go to centre-half alongside Atchison, but we were down to bare bones. So it was 0-0 with about 5 minutes, 10 minutes ago, and it was one of the worst games we've probably been involved in. It was flat. We just signed Curtis Guthrie, he was on the bench. So we got some one reinforcement, but so we've gone from a real poor performance, another poor performance, but 10 minutes ago, Ross Lafayette scores a goal. Bit of a free kick corner, deflection, 6 yards out. Triggles in behind the line, we win 1-0, and then I put Chaz and Dave on that after the game, like London girls, and we're all singing Chaz and Dave. And what we didn't know, having been rollocked the week before to winning now, no one would have foreseen it. We went on and broke the record of, that was just the catalyst of a 13 game winning streak that would potentially help us win the league. You know, without that, we wouldn't have won the league. And it was a, you know, just teacups, a dressing down. And it's amazing how sometimes there's these sliding door moments. You just don't foresee it. And that's why I said earlier on about, you know, what was the plan for the season, or what do you anticipate for that start? We wouldn't, there's no way I can sit here and say we thought we were going to win 13 games, but we just seemed to, something clicked, and a, like, you know, a spawny sort of goal right at the end of a game sent us on a run. And I say that 13 game, that was probably the catalyst to us winning that league that year. Yeah, and all the players, whenever you're together, they'll always remind Daisy about that, you know, day. I think Clarkie's clothes, he went home with tea down his tracksuit, and I'm sure there's a few other tracksuits and T-shirts that had tea and coffee all over them, and sandwiches all over people's trainers. And yeah, unbelievable, that that run. It's, I think it still stands today.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
Everyone has a story, obviously, getting into coaching and management. So, Dean, how did it happen for you?
I was playing up to about 26, 27. I always kept getting knee problems. I had a knee problem at the age of 22, 23, but that just kept, that got in the way of playing. I was stop-start for about the next 3 or 4 years. And in the end, I realised, I thought, my knees are bad. I've become a cab driver, so I've become a bit sedentary and, you know, sitting down. I had pelvis problems as well. So, found out the guy from VCD Reserve said, do you want to come along and help us out a little bit, like, and I could play a little bit, but I could mainly do coaching. I said, you know what, maybe this is the path I need to go down. It keeps me involved in football. Yeah, keeps me involved in a dressing room. So, yeah, Richard Dimmock's dad, funny enough, Mickey Dimmock, he asked me, do you want to come and coach the reserve? So I started from there, and then within about 6 months, Martin Ford, the first team manager, he needed a coach, and I got on board with Martin Ford for another 2 or 3 years, and was part of, like, sort of the, you know, set-up when VCD moved back to their, what is new ground, or the change ground where they turned it around and installed the floodlights. So spent about 2 years at, was Nomads for a few years at Gwynedd Borough, and that's how I got involved in coaching. Yeah, I had a little stint as a caretaker for six games when Martin Ford got sacked or released, however you want to say it, mutual consent. He left the club and I took it on for another six games as the manager. I sort of wanted to stay in, you maybe regret it now, but I wanted to stay in coaching, and you know, Paul Foley took over and I worked alongside Paul for about 2 or 3 years.
So is it fair to say you're a bit of a reluctant manager then? It was the coaching side of it you preferred at that
time?
Yeah,
I enjoyed coaching. I don't know, maybe a bit of fear. I had a bit of fear of taking management on, the fear of organising it all. Fear of, you know, maybe I weren't ready to drop players, upset players, and be that sort of, you know, making a decision to, you know, I wanted to be people's friend. You know what I mean? I didn't want to make, you know, you have to all of a sudden change your role from being not so much people's friend to dropping people, maybe, you know. And we had, it was a friendly club. There was like a mate, like it was a bit like the Welling dressing room. That VCD dressing room was like a, like all mates, you know what I mean, playing together. Like it was more like a, like, yeah, it was a lot of camaraderie then. But maybe look back, I regret I didn't just dip my toe into management a bit sooner, you know, having looked at people that are doing well in management today, you know, like the, you know, there's some good managers that have come from non-league at the moment doing well. And so I have a bit, maybe a little bit of regret, but no, I worked with Paul for 2 years on, or 2 or 3 years, and thoroughly enjoyed it. And we got promoted from the Kent League, which was at the time, to the Ryman. So was part of a small bit of success at VCD.
Yeah, I know you're close friends with Paul Foley, aren't you? I'm sure listeners know he's had a brain tumour. It's obviously common knowledge. It's well known.
Yeah.
How is he? You still in touch with him?
Yeah, I keep in touch with him. He don't always reply. You know, he's very poorly. He's had a slow growth brain tumour for the last 7 years. He's been housebound for 3 of those years now, so I WhatsApp him. He struggles to talk and push his words out. He's very, very sad. But that's why I or us as human beings need to be grateful for our life, you know, how quickly it can change. We were talking before, same with Peter Overton, and you know, and we were talking about Mark Seegers, who's just got the all clear, you know, how quickly life can change, you know. So yeah, very sad, but you know, he's a very good friend of mine. You know, I'm a lot, you know, he showed a lot of faith in me, always, you know, he was a big energy, you know, Paul, and you guys know him from when he was playing, very strong sort of minded sort of player. So he tells me a lot of stories about his moments with the Maidstone fans, where I think he confronted them. I think you might know about that. Very headstrong, but very strong. Knew what he wanted, but very good friend of mine. But very sad. He's not very well. 7 years, a long time to be suffering. But hopefully, still touch wood that they may find one day a cure and something that can to help him get better. But it's very sad.
Yeah, it's quite good. He wrote a book, didn't he, about his dad, Theo? He finished that?
Yeah, we can plug that. Yeah, he wrote a book. He'd done all the research a long time ago. He always wanted to do it. His dad never wanted to do it because his dad's a bit of a... No one's going to want to read my book. But he collected all the information, all the interviews, long before he got become housebound. Collected quotes from all the players of the Arsenal squad, George Graham, Alan Smith, Lee Dixon, Nigel Winterburn, and just wrote a book about Theo's life from Ireland, how difficult it was coming to Ireland as a young lad to Exeter, right through to his playing career, where he went through all the leagues from Division 4 to Division 1 with Northampton in the 60s, and then through to his coaching career, which the pinnacle of his career was winning the league with Arsenal and that famous last-minute goal at Anfield, when Mickey Thomas scored the winner. And I'm quite happy to tell you, he's very proud. He won't tell anyone, but Mickey Thomas would not have stayed at Arsenal if it wasn't for Theo. Theo, encouraged Mickey Thomas. He wanted to leave, and he said, "No, I'm going, I'm leaving." And maybe you won't see the Arsenal you see today as a consequence of that one sliding door moment that he scores that goal. So he's written a book. So I'm rambled on, but I'm plugging it. He's written a book about Theo's career, and it's a really good read, and recommend. It's called Theo, Give Us a Ball, and that comes from the Arsenal fans shouting out Theo, Give Us a Ball, when he used to come out and warm up John Lukic.
So what did Theo say when Michael Thomas ended up at Liverpool?
I'm not sure because Theo wouldn't have been at the club when he left then, but I do know he won't tell you the story. It's only Paul tells me a lot of stories. He said my dad's too proud to sort of tell everyone the story about Mickey Thomas. And he had a real great relationship with David Rocastle as well. He used to drive him in every morning. Paul used to say, I used to get up and go to school, and sitting in my front room was David Rocastle. He said, imagine today, my dad saying, manager of Arsenal, he said, I have a Bamiyam sitting in my front room. Like, he said, I can't, but he said, my dad had a great relationship. I think Theo had a... This is like, I mean, maybe parallels. He's Theo had a great relationship. I think he was a good number two. And also I recognise maybe I was a good number two, a better number two than I'm I protected Daisy or Paul Foley, or I would support them, I'd back them all the way. And maybe you had that relationship with players. And I think Theo, I think he undervalued like a good number two. You see many managers take that same person, they trust them, but... I don't know what he said about when Mickey Thomas left, but I know he don't like talking about it, but he was a big part of Mickey Thomas leaving, because he weren't getting in at the start of George Graham's tenure, and he went, I want to leave, but he stays on, scores a goal to win the league. You never know, you don't see the same Arsenal as you see today.
So you're talking about being a better number two there. Let's go back to when you were the number one at Welling. It didn't last all that long, did it? Tell us what happened.
Oh, I got a phone call during just around Christmas time. Someone saying, "Would you be interested?" And full of fear of years ago. And I thought, do you know what? This is my one opportunity. And I think about it. And anyway, I did at some stage take it. I think middle of January, the team were on a bad run. I was pretty much taken in the ballroom. You got the job, but you're going to have to cut the wage bill. I'm thinking this don't work out right. I go, so I've got to stay in the league, and got a cut. It was quite a significant percent of the wage bill. So I tried to cut it. It weren't easy because there were so many players on contract. There was players on contract that was 52 weeks, or 48 weeks of the year. It was like there's some real bizarre contracts, and that would never have happened under Jamie Day. I know that so I took it on. It took me too long to get a win. I probably didn't make enough changes. I still think about it today, like what would have I changed? What sort of, we clearly needed recruitment, like 3 or 4 new players, a couple of experienced players, but there was no money there. So I had to do a lot of loan signings, a lot of young players, and maybe throwing young players into that sort of situation. you know, lads from that have been on loan from Brentford. They're only playing under 23 football. Maybe it was just too many young lads. You know, with respect to all that squad, you know, maybe just, you know, two or three weren't good enough. You know, that's a fact. But we did eventually get going on a bit of a run. You know, I remember, I think I was about a minute away from beating Cheltenham. We were top of the league, and you think, oh, like we've 1 minute, we score with 7 minutes go. Cheltenham are top of the league. We're at the bottom. We haven't had a win yet, and we're 1 minute away, and we score with 7 minutes go, and we're thinking we're 1 minute away from winning against the team at the top, and they score with the last kick of the game. And I was just thinking, I know football's about what ifs, but just needed a win. I needed a win a bit quicker, and I didn't get that win quick enough to get us on a run. Because once we did win, we won two on the bounce, then had a draw. So I picked, at some stage, picked 7 points up out of nine. But maybe for my first job, it was just the situation I found myself. It was maybe just a team in decline, not getting wins. I had to pick them up, cut the wage bill. Maybe, you know, took the squad was very young. Didn't think we had enough pace in the side, or, you know, real pace and enough experience. You know, I think the average age was about 21, 22, you know. That's a difficult situation to get out of, you know. But we won away, I mean, you know, won away to Tranmere, you know. So you know, I won't forget that. And I logged that in my little book, you know, like as something, a safe keep, you know. We were relegated with two games to go, and then Mark Goldberg took over. And I knew the inevitable. I'd already had phone calls. Phone people rang me up and said, you know, Mark Goldberg's buying the club. I went, all right. And my head straight away went, Goldberg's going to buy the club. He only don't want to just buy the club. Wherever he's been, he likes to manage. So I knew already anyway. So
how did that conversation go with him then?
Actually, funny, it brought me in. I had the phone call. I was in my cab working. Can you come in? We've got something to tell you. Barry rang me up. I thought, I know what's happening. Mark Goldberg's going to be there. And Mark Goldberg gave me I've won the league. I like managing. And I thought again, okay, yes, but I'd like you to take the last two games. Would you be prepared to take the last two games? I think it was one was away to Altrincham, and then I think it was home to Boreham Wood. He said, would you be prepared to take the game? And but you won't. Obviously, you ain't got the job here. I actually think I would have done. He would have done him a favour, keep me at the club, because I knew the club, knew the players. I told him, I was fair to him. He asked me, he'd give him a rundown of all the players, and I actually told him the seven he should keep. He didn't keep one of them. You know, he should have kept, you know, Kevin Locko, Chambers, Harry Lee, Barney Williams, Sam Cook, like the heartbeat of a, didn't keep it, so that went down well. So he asked me who to keep, and then he went, can you take the last two games? And I left it till 24 hours before the game. I went, I can't make it. I was all intention never to do it, but I thought I'd leave it the last 24 hours. You go and take it.
Did you like him or?
I don't know, gradually. I've seen him at a funeral recently about a year ago with Welling, Eric Braxton, who passed away, was president of Welling. I had a conversation with him. I don't hold grudges, you know. Like you know, let's put it this way: in football, there's lots of different characters, different people with different agendas. There's some with very big egos, you know, quite clearly. You can, you know, quite. I'm going to be quite open here. For someone to keep, like he's been the chairman for 3 or 4 years at Welling. I think he's now his second or third stint as manager. He can't let go. He's clearly wants to prove everyone wrong or himself that he's good enough to be a manager. So I don't know grudges. I'm just fully aware that there's lots of big egos and different agendas out there in the world of non-league football and football and in life, you know. So, yeah, I had a good, nice conversation when the last time I seen him. But, I do question what some people are in the game for.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
So once you've left Welling then, what's it like coming out of the game at that point then, Dean? Because you've obviously not been back in. Is it hard to come out of the game?
Yeah, it was a choice in the end. I've been involved for 30. I worked it out. I've been involved for 30 years. At the age of 9 or 10, I started playing football. I didn't stop playing football. As soon as I stopped playing football, I went straight into management or coaching. I read an article the other day by Fraser Franks talking about how tough it is for him or players that have just stop pro. And I know I'm not a pro footballer, but I'm still, football was like a full-time sort of hobby or job to me, you know. I thought about it all the time, you know. It was quite, I noticed for the first 6 months maybe in the cab, I had a lot of time to think. Where I was consumed with football, especially in coaching, I was always looking at YouTube of footage of the opposition we may be playing. I'd be trying to find clips of opposition. So I might be sitting on a rank in my cab at King's Cross watching Forest Green play versus Wrexham and seeing how Forest Green have scored and how Wrexham have conceded or whatever it may be, and just trying to work out what these teams are like and how they play. That was like the... So all of a sudden I've taken football, I'm not playing, I'm not coaching, I've got no tip. You know, I used to drive Daisy mad going, right, I think, you know, what do you think we should do at training? What should we think we'd do, like, do for the next, do you think he should play? Like, he must think, Foster, all he does is just thinks about football, we just want to talk about it. All of a sudden, for 30 years, come away and well in, I made a conscious decision just so I'm going to come out of football for a period anyway. So maybe just got too much time to think. I did notice that, lots of thinking, lots of analysing. I love the phrase analysing is paralysing, you know, like, so I've done lots of thinking. I had nothing, you know, I suppose I had no, what's the word, nothing to strive for at the end of a weekend. It was just, well, I had to, I do not have today, I know I'm going, today, to this day, I know I go work for, my purpose is to go work for my wife and my daughter. And my purpose is to help in other areas, helping others, which I, you know, I'm happy to share about later on.
Fair to say at that time, though, that you found yourself going down the dark road?
This is an area I really love to share. I'd had problems with gambling for about 20 years, you know, so in between coaching, I'd had problems. I'm a compulsive gambler, and I'd struggled during playing. Although I actually played really well when I was gambling, funny enough, it maybe was my release. When I was younger, I played at Bromley, and I'll never forget, I was gambling heavily about 2002, 2003, and I played quite well for a couple of seasons for different clubs. And then, but I'd battled gambling for about 20 years. And so what coincided with stop being involved in football is my gambling sort of took off, increased, you know. My former gambler, I'd love betting shops for some reason. I got drawn to betting shops, got drawn to the horses and dogs. Not so much football, the results took too long. I needed instant. And so out of football, my gambling took off and it accelerated at a speed of knots, you know. And, you know, with losing lots of money and along the way losing, you know, with money and with having to lie my head, you know. So, you know, I know it's massive in society now, in football, the adverts, and yeah. So I'm happy, really happy to share this. You know, I've never really shared with anyone. I might put little bits on Twitter about gambling. People might, have a go. Or, you know, I've only got about 500 followers, so whoever does look, but might get a gist and go, "Coy puts a lot on about gambling." But yeah, my gambling excelled after stopping and being involved in football.
So you come out of football, you're in that dark place, should we say, where you're. Where you're gambling, are you consciously aware of what you're doing? Or is it the case that you're just so enclosed in going down that road?
Do you know what? I'll make it clear. So I'm never here for a poor me, or you know, I'm not. So because people, lots of people have an opinion about addiction. Quite a lot often, people don't realise it ain't always a choice. Once I didn't start out as a gambling when I was 20 to know that, think I was going to be a compulsive gambler, you know, same as an alcoholic. They don't start drinking, turn out to be an alcoholic. You know, but you can't stop. I don't know about, you know, other addictions. I know they're all pretty similar. It's all probably a form of escapism. It's all a bit of about an immature behaviour, and I'm happy to share, you know, some of my thoughts why. But you are aware, but you know, like, I'd wake up in the morning and go, right, I'm going to work in my cab. And I maybe gambled consecutively for 100 days and wake up in the morning and go, right, then go work. Don't go in a betting shop today. Just do not go in that betting shop. Just get your head down, work, graft, and at 5 o'clock go home to your wife and daughter. At some stage in the day, there's a little voice in it will go, go on, just go and have a little, you know, you don't have to work for the next 4 hours. Rather than working, go and win it quicker. Go and have a tenner on an 8-to-1 shot, or go and have a 20 quid on a 20-to-1 shot, win your money and go home. So you sort of do know what you're doing, but it's hard to explain. I think an element with gambling, you've lost your money, you can't accept what's gone, so you keep going for your losses. You just keep going, and, you know, even if I've won money back, all that money was his ammunition to carry on going. So I've never won money and stood outside the betting shop and took a breather and go, Dean, you've won X amount here. This could pay a credit card debt off and this can pay for a family holiday. Go on. I've never done that. You know, I've never had that ability to sort of have a... What's it? And there's no filter. When I start gambling, there's no filter. I haven't got that ability to just to take a big deep breath and just take a thought about this money in my hand. All that money is ammunition to go again. So, it's funny. It's really it's a surreal feeling to be a compulsive gambler or any form of addict. You know you've got the problem, but you can't stop it. But in the end, it was so painful, you know, In the end, it's painful, you know. Like if I said to you, I can't stop eating beef burgers, you Matthew and Craig, you go to me, we'll stop going to McDonald's. I go, I can't explain it. I've got these automatic feet that track me into McDonald's, and I've got this mouth that says, "Mate, can I afford but burgers, please?" It's so hard to explain. It's an out of body, slightly an out of body experience. You've got these automated legs that just, or the mind that takes you into a betting shop. Once you know that was my form of gambling. I know today gambling is. So more freely available because of technology and the apps, you know. And we've seen it this last week, you know. The part, you know, I'll go on my rant. I don't get too much in a rant about gambling industry. I know it's big. I know it's growing. So I only focus on the solution. But I thought what the FA did last week in partnership with Bet365 with the FA Cup. And then at the same breath, that third round was every game was delayed by 1 minute. For mental wellness and emotional wellness. You know, you think, you know, if you realise what addiction does to people, it is partly emotional and it is a mental obsession. You know, addictions are a mental obsession, you know. So you go, how contradictory the FA. They're trying to promote health and well-being, but at the same time, they're promoting a gambling company, you know, all in partnership. So I'm fully aware today that, you know, gambling is accelerating. I'm glad I've stopped now. Because I'm fully I've arrested it. I can say I could go back tomorrow if I wanted to, but I'm fully aware that how fast paced gambling is and how it's out there. You know, I sit behind a bus, there's an advert. Sit on the tube, there's an advert. You sit at a set of traffic lights, a billboard. You know, you sit and watch telly at half time. You know, Ray Winston, famous people are coming out and telling you, come and get on at half time and listen to any sport radio or any, you know, commercial radio. They're advertising gambling, so it's massive.
It's interesting you say as well about being an addiction. I remember reading something not so long ago where the perception almost in society is that if you're an alcoholic or if you're a gambler, that you're a bad person in that. It's a bad thing to be doing, therefore you're a bad person. But it's not. It's an illness, isn't it? It's a bit more than that.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research. I've done a lot of work on myself in the last year. And I'm really interested in human behaviour. And, you know, not everyone, but lots of people. Let's use the example. We go in London, in doorways, there's a lot of homeless people. You know, a lot of them are probably alcoholic, a lot of them are heroin addicts. I've now discovered that most of them people have got a story to tell, you know, quite open. I think a guy called Gabor Mate, who's an addiction specialist in Canada, says 75% of those addicts have been abused sexually, physically, mentally. You know, had deaths in the family, break up. You know, they've got a story to tell. So once they found drink or heroin, it covers the pain. So they're, you know, they're quite often they're covering their pain of their childhood. So there's a phrase, most addiction starts in pain and ends in pain. So anyone that sort of just, you know, and I've heard it, you know, pick, don't give your money to them, you know, or don't, look at them, you know, look at them on the street, look at this, you know, scumbag. People would say, they're not. They're just a human being that have had an experience, and so I'm so grateful for the upbringing I've had. You know, upbringing that, you know, the surroundings or the social environment I've been brought up in. So you're right. That's what I say at the start. I didn't start out as when I put my first bet on, and maybe 15, 16, 17 with a coupon, like the fixed odds, or whatever. I didn't set out to be an addict or a compulsive gambler. Same way as these people didn't set out when they first had a drink. And maybe the person on the street that's living in a doorway, and I've shared that person that's had a drink for the first time ever, and go, "God, this drink's covering my pain." You know, like it blocks out all of my memory of my childhood. I was abused or beaten up as a kid. I was bullied as, you know. So, it's you're spot on with that assumption. Most of these people, actually all they want to do is be loved, and have connections, but they have, you know, they found connection with heroin. They found a connection with drink that covers their pain. But you know, I'm fortunate. I would never really had that. You know, I never went to that depth. And they say greater the addiction, greater the pain. That's what I've heard. So my addiction was bad, but I can honestly say I had a good upbringing. Mine was probably purely down to sort of habitual. I just loved the thrill of it. But some of the other addicts we're talking about, away from, you know, in the doorway, is more real. They're masking pain, they're covering pain, and they're just ordinary people. They're just nice people. It could happen to anyone, you know.
You talk about what's happened to you when you're at the gambling's at its highest and it's worse from your perspective. What sort of levels are we talking on, and how often were you betting?
Every day. Start off with it. You know, my intention would be this: the head would go, just go and have one bet. I went in and I might have had 100 bets. My head might, on the other case, go, right, you've got X amount in your pocket, XX amount in your pocket. Just go in the betting shop and just do that. Well, I can tell you now, I was running backwards before credit card. I mean, I used to use cash. I used to run backwards and forwards to the ATM like a lunatic. I mean, it's funny, there's an homeless guy who used to sit next to the ATM and go, you back again? He must have known I was a compulsive gambler. He went, you're worse. Like, you know, he's sitting there with a can of beer and he's going, you're worse than me. So I'd run backwards and forwards. It would be unlimited time. It was unlimited money. Whatever I could get my hands on. The only thing that would stop me is if I'd run my maximum for the day. So my bank would only let me allow me so much out of the ATM, or so much would be allowed out of my credit card, whatever. And that, you know, I would smash myself to pieces as long as I could keep going. And I wouldn't say I did eye bets. Mine was more bets just to keep me involved for the whole day. The closest buzz I got to the buzz of gambling, the anticipation of going to put that bet on, the anticipation of putting the betting slip over the counter, the anticipation of the stall handlers putting the horse in, was the same anticipation before a game, being involved in football. I used to have the butterflies before, like we've shared before here. Match week would be training, having the team talk, and when them players went out 2 minutes before the game, the butterflies, the nervousness, a little bit of, it's an amazing feeling for some reason, and it's all even greater feeling when you've won after a game. But that was what gambling replicated. That uncertainty is that my horse is being loaded into the stalls, and that uncertainty, is it going to come out? Is it going to just come out last, or is it going to come out first? Or is it, you know, and where is it in amongst the pack? And it's like, it's an adrenaline rush, it's a buzz, it's a high, it's all about the feeling for me, that's why I probably gamble. It just changes, gives me a feel good, you know, a lift and an uplift, and I don't know, potentially I can win it quicker, but I never won quicker because it always went back. It
takes over your life, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, consumed by it. I look back at my behaviour with football. I was probably addicted to football because I ate, slept and drank it alongside gambling. The only thing that never got a look in is my wife, my daughter, and my work. I never threw myself into work, you know what I mean? So it was, it's consuming. It's consuming. And so partly being on this podcast is, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, there's many people out there struggling. You know, I know footballers. I know pro footballers and non-league. You know, at the moment, there's a lot of pro footballers doing campaigns about addiction. You know, there's a load of non-league footballers out there. There's a load of ordinary people out there that need help. Do you know what I mean? As well as my message is, you know, like, reach out. But I'm a bit of a... I don't know if you've seen a lot of campaign talk up, but I don't think you can talk to anyone. I truly don't believe everyone wants to hear your story. You know, like, if someone said you've got a gambling problem, you know, I couldn't go and sell certain mates because they're not going to help. They're going to go, oh, go away, you're a nutter. Like, you know, go and find someone that you trust, really trust, and tell them, and they might be able to direct you, you know. Yeah, it's just getting the message out there, you know, because I think this is an addiction that's going to take off. There's 400,000 addicts, compulsive gamblers now in the country. I would say in the next few years it's going to grow as a consequence of gaming, children's gaming, that the pathway is to turn these next generation into, I think they're called Generation X anyway, and the kids that play on gaming, they're going to go into a world of consumerism or gambling. Lots of them are going to get lost.
I don't think you ever solve the problem in sense of once you have that addiction, you know, you have to come up with means to stop it and to prevent.
Yeah.
What where was your point? Where was the point where you stopped? And was there a moment that you then went to get help? Or yeah. how did it turn around for you?
I've often gotten to the same fellowship on and off for years, but quite often it's when I don't attend them this fellowship I go, or this like group I go to, I go back gambling. So now I go maybe two or three times a week. So the pain was, it, funny enough, it wasn't one of my biggest my biggest bets. It was just I had a small amount of money left in my bank account. I was in Nunhead and I went in this Willie Mills. It was like a minimal amount and it was all I had left. I had max credit cards. I had two loans. And I went in thinking I'm going to conquer the world with this middly amount of money. And I put it over the counter. I lost it within minutes. And for some reason, somewhere, it was like, I've had enough. It was like the pain's too much. Actually, I didn't know how I was going to get out of it because I'd reached the end of getting loans. You know, I was getting rejected for loans, rejected for credit cards. I didn't really want to go down the route of payday loans. So I drove back home after leaving work for 2 hours. My missus was indoors working from home. She went, what are you doing here? I went, I've gambled again. She went, right. And she said, right, you're going back to your meetings, but you're going to go and see a psychotherapy, a therapist or counsellor, whatever. You're going to do something different as well as going to your meetings. And but I started in the fellowship I go to, they have a thing called a recovery programme. So I started a recovery programme with a mentor. And work through that and do a lot of work on personal development, self awareness. Just unraveling. I'm rewiring the brain. Like it's like I can only say when I finish gambling, my head's like the spaghetti junction, or a bowl of spaghetti bolognese, and I need to unravel that spaghetti. I need to unravel it and start thinking logically like a normal person. But one of the best things I ever do now is for the last 2 years I've written a gratitude list every morning before I go work, and it's turned my life around. Like that one thing alone, and I'll recommend it to anyone. It's the best thing I've ever done, because realising what you've got, because quite easy you think I've stopped gambling but I haven't got anything, but I've got loads, you know. So I'll do a gratitude list every day. It's the most powerful thing I do.
Yeah. How important was the support of your wife as well?
Yeah, it was hard because it wasn't always, it was support, but I mean, behind every good man is a good woman. I truly believe that. So my wife is very supportive. She's very aware, but at the same time, she made it quite clear that she weren't very happy. But then if I think it's going to be easy, then I might go back again. So I need that. She was angry, lost trust. She's uncertain whether her husband's actually going to work, or is he going to work, or is he in the William Hills again? Is he going to come home with any money? You know, like. So yeah, the support's really massive. You know, I'd probably undervalue how important that support is, but at the same time, I need it to be angry as well. You know, because I think if she's not angry, I'm probably going to go back. So massive.
We'll talk about gambling in football in a second as well. Or just one final thing. Yourself now, are you in a good place? You said you stopped gambling.
I haven't had a bet for 2.5 years. I'm in a good place. So I still go to my meetings. I've still got a mentor, but the part of the program is I mentor others now. So it's like a pass down. You pass what you've learnt on. You know what I mean? It's not a secret. It's not a secret society or any sort. But it's just it's actually great for life. It's a program for life. You know. So I would say I wish I had it when I was managing and coaching, because I'd be more of aware of a person. I think it's very important that people are aware of themselves. You know, like we've got many people, football managers and coaches, that don't know themselves. So I'm not saying, but this is a great program for life. You know, and so I'm in a good place. I have a bit of flat, every now and again, but I've got no desire to gamble. That obsession's lifted. Just trying to help others. Like the key to it for me now is helping others. That keeps me safe, you know. It's my insurance policy, and if I can help anyone through this podcast, any gambling, any addiction can be stopped. But you've got to really want it as well. You know, it comes from within. Yeah, so I'm in a good place. And
I just wondered on the gambling. Do you know how much you've lost over the years?
No, do you know what? I've never totaled it up, but I know there's a few players. I mean, there's a guy called Scott Davis. There's a lot of footballers that do a lot of work on addiction, and The problem, like, there was a news article the other day, Andros Townsend, I think he said he lost 40,000 in one night. But it was, so I would never share what I've lost, because I think it's quite dangerous, a headline of 400,000, or I've seen so-and-so lost 200,000 in their gambling life. Which, now, if there's someone out there that's lost only 10,000, or say only, if there's someone that's lost 10,000 but they can't afford to lose 10,000, that's a news article from Andros Townsend of 40,000 or the 200,000 from someone else, it glamorises it. So if I look at it and I've only, you know, I may have lost 20,000, but if I look at it and go, well, I haven't lost enough yet, that doesn't qualify me to be a compulsive gambler. So I've never, does that make sense? Yeah. You know, I think sadly the papers glamorise the amount people lose, and then there's people out there going, well, you know, there might be someone on incapacity benefit only losing, or so only losing their benefits each week. Well, they might be looking, going, well, Andrew Trans has lost 40,000. I'm not worthy of it. I'm not a compulsive gambler. I don't need help because I have never lost. So I've never really totaled it up. I know it was. I mean, I'm still paying for it a day. I've got another 4 or 5 years until I pay my debts off.
Mm. So you were getting loans out specifically to gamble. So you had to sort of go into banks and basically lie to get a loan, kind of thing. Or?
My intention was to get the loan to pay the debt off and then consolidate and then stop gambling. Each time I got the loan out, I consolidated, but then add a little bit extras left over and go, well, I use it. You know, if I got a loan out for XXX, but I had X left after paying all my my debts, I go, if I use that, I might be able to win the loan, and I'll pay the loan off with this last little bit left. So, yeah, I was actually one of the criteria when they go into a bank and they go, what's your loan for? And I went, and I got stumbled once. I said, and the woman on the phone gave me a list of things that I could claim a loan for. One of them was gambling debts. So they was actually willing to give you debt for gambling, like, or gambling debt. I went, well, in the end, I just said consolidation and DIY and a car. Problems with car, consolidation, really. But they are openly willing. I think it's changing now because I think banks are now tightening up. There's a few companies and a few credit cards are now going to start restricting gambling on the internet because they know so many people are doing it through credit cards.
Mm. So did you ever share it with friends at all, what's sort of happening? Or?
Yeah, a few, but that's why I'm very dubious about this campaign at the moment about mental health or addiction. Just tell people. Not everyone wants to hear it. So, you know, I could tell people, but some of my mates might have looked at me and go, you're a lunatic. Just don't walk into a betting shop then, Dean. And go, well, don't narrow, like, you don't, the obsession, if there was a parking space outside a betting shop, my cab had this automatic steering wheel that pulled up outside, reversed itself in. I had these automated legs that took me into a betting shop, and it was an obsession. I just needed it to be, you know, I'd either look around the internet for places for people to go. There's a fellowship, I can't name the fellowship, but people can guess because it goes against why. But there's plenty of places. But yeah, I would just, if you do need to share with a friend that you really trust, you know, not just share with anyone, because some people don't get it. Same as mental health. Some people go, you know, if anyone said, I feel depressed, some people go, I'm not talking to, like, there's a stigma, and like, I'm not talking to him, like, he's a depressant, like, or, you know. But my message would be to talk to someone that you value and trust, that you think you can, like, open up to.
Yeah, I suppose just last on that. When you look back, do you think it ever got in the way of your football when you're sort of thinking about betting or putting bets on? Or
yeah, maybe with my temper, you know, like, I've got myself into some terrible situations. I've got into some fights with some of my own players at some stage, and I would say that it was a consequence of a week's worth of, like, or a week or a month's worth of gambling, where I went to work with my head had gone. You know, like, I'd lost a load of money. You know, as a consequence of being a gambler, I've become impatient, lack of tolerance. I've become, like, you know, a bit angry. You know, like, so I'm, you know, you're not thinking clearly. You know what I mean? I'm consumed by what I've done, or I might have been in the betting shop before. I was often late when I played at Bromley. I was always late on the coach because I was putting my bets on. Always remember, I look back and thinking, if I was a manager of myself, I'd be going mad. Why are you late on the coach? It's always you. We're running 15 minutes late because of you. I would have driven a manager mad. But I was putting my bets on, like, you know, I couldn't wait. I couldn't get enough. I mean, that was when I was doing football coupons, because I would just get or accumulate. It's getting all my bets on so I can put them in my bag. And when I finish football, I can open up my bag and have a look, see where I've won any money.
Dean, one of the things that's happened a lot lately, I don't know if you go on the FA website, you'll see a lot of charges for non-league players. George Porter is a prime example, a local footballer who's been banned from playing for a year for betting, because players down to step four, which is the Isthmian South East Division, are not allowed to bet on football now, which is a rule introduced a few years ago. How rife do you think it is in the game, just from your experience? I mean, we can't talk about individual cases and whatever, but do you think it's a problem?
I think it is. I mean, I can't talk. I don't know. I know a few footballers or non-league footballers personally that have got problems with gambling. I think it's greater than... I think I know the organisation. I went on a GamCare convention and they spoke about it's more prevalent in team sports because it's that banter between players. So a player might come and go, oh, I won X amount last week on an accumulator. Well, it might be a couple of players next to them that are 18, have never bet, and go, what's that? You go, I had four teams up. I put X amount on. I've won like 210 quid. And them young lads go, do you know what? And they download the app or go into a betting shop and do a coupon. So it apparently is very... I think research shows in team sport it's greater than you know, in normal life, just because of that banter or that camaraderie or that sense of belonging. You know, everyone, you know, like the ego, I won so-and-so, I got it right today. So I think in football, I believe so. Yeah, you know, there's people, I know it's not all about money, but people are struggling out there to survive or have money in their pocket, you know. Initially, when you win a few quid, your first ever bet, quite often most compulsive gamblers have won their first few bets. That's why they become compulsive. You know, them young lads that are 18 have had their first bet and they win instantly. Their head goes, cool, I can make a living out of this. And you know, why don't next week I'll have a little bit more on? You know, like rather than just winning 200, if I double up, I win 400. And then later on, a year later, find out that winning's not as easy as there's only one winner in betting. I do think it's... in terms of, I've actually got a bit of an opinion. I don't know George's situation or the situation with George, but I do think, you know, with AI and artificial intelligence, you know, data, you know, it took over 400 bets before he got found. You know, you go, why are these betting companies doing more to protect? If they know it's a rule, they, you know, it can't be that hard to find out what this person does for a living. And, you know, they've allowed it. I think it was over a few year period and 400 bets, was it right?
473
Yeah,
bets.
So, you know, I don't know with different companies, but surely they can do their own work as well. And they've waited for him. You know, they're happy to take his money.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which is a bizarre thing. But as you say, I think it could be the tip of the iceberg in that sense. But when you've been in and around the game, any level of support for anything? Was this ever an issue discussed? Was it? I mean, it's becoming more and more prevalent now.
Yeah,
but you're not necessarily in touch with.
Do you know? I suppose once again, I suppose with dress rooms, you might only be in a squad for 1 year. You might move clubs. You know what I mean? So you don't build that rapport up with, you know, unless you're one of them players that have been at a club for a long time and you've got a relationship with four or five players that have been there the same as you. Then you might go, I really like so-and-so, what he has to say. He's quite a nice, like, he's a compassionate person. So you might go, right, I'm going to go and have a chat with one of my teammates. But I think it's quite difficult finding that person that you want to open up to. You know what I mean? You know, the stigma is, like, right now there's a bigger, big campaign, obviously, for mental health. You know, is it the Heads Up campaign? You know, the lad that's got load of banter, you go, oh, I can't tell him. Like, he's the jack of joke of the dressing room, and I've got a mental health. Do I tell him? Well, you're probably not, because you've got this perception that he's the joker. So you're looking around the dressing room, who can I have a chat to? It's difficult, you know, because you're judging yourself. You go, oh, God, if I tell so-and-so, they're going to think I'm a bit of a nutter or I'm a bit of a crazy person. They think I'm not all the ticket. And you go, you don't want that stigma attached to you, so... The good thing is there's campaigns out there now being pushed. You know, I mean, I know there's footballers out there doing talks to pro clubs, you know, but what we've got to remember, there's non-league clubs that are, you know, players with no money that are probably gambling, you know, like ordinary people that are gambling. So I'm not sure I know there's campaigns with the FA, but maybe there could be a lot more done. But gambling funds football and footballing fund gambling right now. You know what I mean? It goes hand in hand.
Should point out that The Football League introduced at the start of last season a responsible gambling campaign designed to educate players and staff from their clubs over the next 5 years. Interesting though, I did look on the National League website this morning to see what kind of presence there was gambling wise.
Right.
In that sense, there's a couple of promotions for the league's betting partner, but there's not anywhere you on there that noticeable to me anyway, that if I was a player in that league that I could go on to and click on to and find some support or some help, you know?
Yeah, I think we live in a society where money's a big part in everyday life. They need funding, like the leagues need funding, so they're happy to promote it rather than help it. And again, I think just before he became manager, but they carried the adverts on, you know. I think Mourinho was doing an advert for one of the big betting companies, you know what I mean? And he can promote it, but Premier League down to step four can't bet on. You know, it's a bit contradictory, but it's because there's money involved that they can promote it. But we clearly need help in and amongst non-league footballers. You know, there needs to, all life. You know, Premier League footballers right down to non-league footballers down and ordinary people. There needs to be more of a campaign. So clearly, the conference website needs to, you know, there needs to be more help. Some adverts for some of the organisations that do help people with you know, it's just not gambling. It could be any addiction. Do you know what I mean? I can't answer why they do it. Well, I can answer. It's money. They're advertising it because they need funding, but they don't want to help the other way around. Why that is, maybe hopefully it improve over the next few years. I mean, it's slowly getting there. There's more campaigns, aren't there, for mental health and addiction. So,
for anyone who's listening and has been affected by what we've been speaking about, the National Gambling Helpline, which is operated by GamCare, that you mentioned earlier, offers confidential support, advice, and free counselling to people concerned about their gambling or the gambling of friends and family. And it's the phone number for that is 0808 802 0133, and we'll obviously put those details on the web story which attached to this podcast as well.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
Dean, let's move on to Ebbsfleet United. Time there, obviously you left Welling, the bright lights as I described in the intro, but obviously the lure of the financial package that Ebbsfleet could provide Jamie Day, and it obviously went as a management team. How do you look back now on the 6 months at Ebbsfleet?
Well, I think it's 4 months, isn't it? It's really strange period of my life as well. Never really, looking back, just never really settled in. Very different to Welling, wasn't it? You know, so at Welling, we had low expectations. Went to Ebbsfleet, you know, to stark contrast, there was lots of money and had big expectations. New ground, wanted promotion. The wages that were being paid to the players and the staff. So very quickly, you've gone from Welling. I think we went away. Our last game was away win at Telford. You know, spit and sawdust Welling. Travelling with bare minimal players. I think we had loads on loan, loads of injuries. We might have had three on the bench, a couple of youth team players on the bench. And we've clawed a 2-1 win up. And then we're low expects. And then we very quickly, 24 hours later, we're in at Ebbsfleet and the expectations changed. So I've got to say, what an enjoyable for me. I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't enjoy the atmosphere around the whole place, but that's my perception, do you know what I mean? So I learned from it, you know. I've learned from life is that, you know, every situation or every experience, there's something to be learned from, you know. I'm happy to shit. I often say it to Daisy, you know, and I look at some of the managers that have done well from non-league and gone on. You know, maybe within hindsight, you're probably looking at a going to a club that had a similar Welling, had low expectations, and so built our way up through the league or the non-league and maybe potentially league with clubs similar to Welling, but a higher level and didn't have expectations. It was tough, you know. But there was a lot of contradictory stuff that went on beyond, you know, within the first couple of weeks. You know, 1 minute being told, you know, we don't expect a certain amount, and then next thing, Jamie called up to Knightsbridge and saying, what do you think of the players? Jamie gave his opinion on the players and you know, he's been told, right, get rid of all the players you want and bring them all in. So with an hindsight, you know, we often have a little conversation with Jamie, would you change players very quickly like we did, or next time if it ever happened again, would you go do it slowly, more progressively? Because there was wholesale changes when we went in. After about 3 weeks, that was it. It was like a load of players going out and load of players coming in. you live and learn. Was that right? Was that wrong? But that was the message and the directions given from above. You know, change. You know, we're going to give you the. I think Jamie was given the green light to you can now clear the players out and bring you one in. We're prepared for next season. But maybe too many changes and maybe signed quite a lot of players. You know, a couple of players that were too similar. Whereas that's what I said. Welling, looking back, Welling, it just worked out. It fitted in. You had a holding midfielder and an attacking midfielder. Jamie Day and Lee Clark, looking back, maybe, you know, some of the signings you make, because it was pressure on to sign very quickly, you know, probably just who was available, you know, like, who could we get, who's free in the contract, who can we get? Yeah, things happen. I think we maybe too many changes too quickly, but as an atmosphere, it's funny atmosphere at the training ground, funny atmosphere. I think the players were very, very close to Brownie, made it very difficult. And then when they were, I think, the dynamics. If you're a player and you think, "Am I going or am I staying?" You know, there's maybe a, you know, the atmosphere downstairs where they was having dinner. Go, "Am I the next one out? Am I the, you know?" So that obviously creates a bit of uncertainty and fear in that environment. So, all in all, I think there's a big lesson to be, lots of lessons to be learned. If I or Daisy or Ash ever went back into that sort of environment again, you know, you learn from that experience.
At the end. Did you know it was coming? Did you think it was going to happen?
I was surprised, actually. I was surprised. I mean, clearly knew the results weren't right. But yeah, I was surprised. I thought we might have been given pre-season. I think the pre-season was being planned by Jamie. I thought we'd be given like a bit of a clean. So once you get back to pre-season, every player that's there then knows that they're part of the squad. I think the problem we had it was January, February, March, April, was that where there was players coming and going, they was all looking around going, "Is it me next?" So no one could ever settle. I think if it got to the summer play, it might have settled down a little bit. Yeah, there was too many fractions, you know. Even I think as the board, there was fractions up there. I've always got the impression that there was never united. You know, there was three or four characters up there all in it for their personal gain. So right up there was people, you know, not pulling together, maybe lots of difference of opinions, and they all letting know so they weren't getting on. So, you know, it weren't a united club, I don't think. That was an eerie 4 months. I didn't enjoy it, but I probably wasn't in a good headspace myself anyway, potentially probably gambling at the time as well, so, you know.
Do you think you would have got it right had you been given the time?
I'd like to think so, you know, there was lots of good players there. Do you know what I mean? We signed league players, signed players that had all played much higher. You have to believe in yourself, and you'd like to think that we would have done.
Were you comfortable with everyone sort of spoke about the money that was being paid out? I think it was a big budget, wasn't it? Were you comfortable with the sort of money that was being thrown around there?
I suppose it's just going back to what I said very at the very start, you know, that contrast from Welling, less expectations, to Ebbsfleet, the expectations, money, the new ground being built, the owner, you know, like, I think probably clearly created extra pressure in games, you know, or there was maybe a little bit of pressure on players. They felt maybe a little bit nervous. I mean, it still took them another couple of years to get promoted, you know what I mean? So it wasn't, they never got promoted the following year. I think it took another year. So I'm sure there was, all those players had to acclimatise to a different sort of pressure. Do you know what I mean? So even if some players had come from league clubs, so they might have played for a league club that had no pressure. They would come to a non-league club and potentially sometimes come into a non-league thinking, "Oh, I'll just be able to coast this level." You still have to roll your sleeves up at the start of the game and work as hard as that the opposition. So maybe it creates a bit of fear, create a bit of nervousness on and off the pitch. I think it, and also the opposition want to beat you. You know, they want the scalp of beating that team that's paying X amount of a player up front and X amount, you know, that. So there's a lot that's thrown into the mix, you know what I mean? So it makes it, I definitely think it makes it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, so gambling's under control, you're happy.
Yeah.
You're going to get back into football?
Not at the moment. I've got to focus on working hard. My focus is on just trying to stay well, work hard for my wife and my daughter. But a couple of my mates keep ringing, "Come and do my son's team, come and coach them." But it's all, the thing is, like, you know, what people don't realise, non-league level, it's time consuming, do you know what I mean? So even at the end, we got a little bit of money, extra money at Ebbsfleet. But over the 5 years at Welling, I got paid, but it wasn't paid the amount that I needed, you know, like to live. You know, I was getting off, to Macclesfield away, and I was getting off the train, my cab was parked around the corner of Euston Station. So we'd been Macclesfield on a Saturday, getting back at Euston Station at 9. I was getting in my cab to go back to work. I haven't been out for the whole day. And even if you're on the touchline, it's like mentally draining, you know? I'd like to finish on it. I don't know if you ever listen, but, you know, I'm really glad I've come on here. And, I listened to a podcast and I sent to Matthew before, Andy Pugh. He spurred me on to share, come on and share. Andy Pugh shared about was it a year ago you had him on? Like, you know, talk, you know, it just shows that people, you know, how many people think non-league football, you know, people, you know, we do it for fun and we do it for enjoyment, but people, we do care about what we do, you know. And if anyone hasn't heard, like, and I heard Andy Pugh's like podcast on here a year ago, and like the authenticity and how much someone cares, you know. Most non-league footballers and coaches that do their job actually go and do it because they love it as well, do you know what I mean? But they put their heart and soul into it. So I just want to say, like, for Pewey, for, like, thanks for, like, that he shared. It really, like, touched it touched something, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I love authenticity and, like, realness and, people talking from their heart. And, yeah, thanks for the opportunity to come and share my story.
We're not going to let you go just yet, Dean. We've got a couple of quick fire questions, which we do like to throw in at our guests every now and then. Best ground that you've ever played at and possibly maybe coached at as well?
Do you know what? I've never played pro. I played for Welling Reserves years ago and we used to play at all the league grounds. For nostalgia and for memories, let's say managing Tranmere Rovers. Is it Prenton Park?
That's the one.
1-0 down after about 10 minutes, thinking we were under the Battle of the Alamo, was under pressure, was all over the place, and we scored this deflected goal from a galley, and then we scored a great goal to win the game, one of the best goals I've been involved in. And I'm sure it wasn't training ground stuff, then players just did it themselves. But let's say Prenton Park for nostalgia and for the 3 points that we got on that day, and you know, going to a place where full-time club against a team full of youngsters showing some real balls and guts to get and character to win that day.
On the flip side, what ground did you never enjoy going to? You always got beaten.
Oh, do you know what? Listen, we shared this the other day. I don't know why. It's actually not a bad ground because it's only a 20 year old. But we never done well at Welling at Dorchester. It was a bogey ground. I think Joe really got sent off there once or twice. But if he didn't get sent off, the whole team used to play terrible, and I had this big centre half that used to wind us up. I can't think of his name, do you know, Crichton or something. It used to be the big centre half. We got beat there, or if the best we ever done, we got a draw, but it was a bogey ground. So although it was a nice ground, it was always windy. We come away with some horrendous results.
I normally ask managers what's the best signing you've made in terms of you signed a player and you weren't expecting to get him. Yeah. So half that question, but also who's the best, you know, in terms of getting someone and coaching them and then making them better than what you thought they were going to be? Which players have surprised you to be that good?
No, about surprising. There was a period where on a Friday I used to go and work with Louis Cumbers, Andy Pugh and Loic. They used to coach the Welling youth team down in Eltham. And I warmed to them three. They were, at the time, they were hungry. Really, the three of the nicest lads. They actually become best. They was all best mates. Well, Louis and Pewy sound like a cartoon character, don't they? They were best mates. And then Loic just fitted in with them three. And so I like working with them because they were hungry. They'd both all been released by pro clubs, but they were at 20, 21, 22. They were hungry. And we just used to work on a little bit of movement, how they could help one another. So I enjoy working with them. But all the players at Welling, I loved them all. Do you know what I mean? Jake Gallagher, loved him. He, you know, one of the, you know, an absolute beast on the pitch. And you've seen some of his tackles. But, you know, he's the nicest man I've ever met in my life. He's the poshest, nicest person. But if you'd see him on the pitch, you think he should be playing rugby. He should be smashing people in a ruck, you know, like, but... But he was like, you know, great attitude. He'd stay up, pick the kit up, pick the cones up, bring the balls in. Like, so that, you know, a lot of them Welling players, I loved that. I loved my time there, like the 5 years, you know. But there was loads, you know. But Barney was like young, hungry, like lad. But like, Jamie worked with Barney at his college and brought him in. But like, yeah, there was loads of like great, like all they were all great lads, and that was a great dressing room. Do you know what I mean? Even when players come and go, the new ones that come in were great. So, yeah, I can't really pick. You know, I love them all.
I think I know the answer to this one, but no one else will. Best player you played with during your career?
With? Oh yeah. Do you know what? I forgot. Yeah. Well, I would never. It's amazing. Steve Finnan. Well, because I got taken on as a youth team. I think only Yeovil and Welling were doing a youth scheme back in the early 90s. And Welling took on eight young lads that had been released by pro clubs and took them on to do a YTS scheme. So, yeah, Steve Finnan was in it. But I'll be honest, I'd never known he was going to have the career. I mean, not this is not sounding disrespectful. You just don't go, he's going to play for Liverpool. I think he played 250-odd league games for Liverpool. I think he played at World Cup, scored penalties, shootouts at a World Cup finals. And then you think, and I remember that year for 1 year, he was nigh on offer with ME, the energy sapping illness. So he actually had 1 year off at the age of about 17, and we never see him nigh on, like, for the whole season, and come back. And then the next thing, very quickly, he's into the first team. But Kevin Ells must have seen something in him because he put him into the first team very quickly. And he just, you know, went, I think, Birmingham, Notts County, Fulham, and then to Liverpool. I mean, what a career, eh?
Best player you played against?
I haven't had that great. Oh, I tell you, I played for Welling Reserves, and we went away to Brentford. And they played some of their players that were injured. And I was 17, 18. And we played against Carlos Saba, who played for, later on went up to Gillingham in the end, didn't he? I think he had quite a reasonable career. He scored a hat-trick very easy. He bashed me everywhere. You know, like, he was about 6'4", and I was a 17, 18-year-old little jumpster, like, you know, like, skinny little kid, a bit skinnier than I am now. So, yeah, probably, I've played against a few, but he was very, very good. I couldn't get, I remember playing midfield against Ollie Barquez, who used to play with Chelmsford. And he was very good foot. I couldn't get anywhere near him. I played midfield a couple of games. And I thought, I don't like it here. I can't get nowhere near this bloke. But he was quite technical, I think. He was very, like, known to be quite a technically good footballer. So, yeah, Ollie Burke was as well for a non-league.
Dean, thanks very much for coming in. Thanks very much for your honesty and being so open with us. If your story, your life, what you've gone through can help just one person who listens to the podcast, then it'll be well worth sharing. And good to see you looking so well, and wish you well in the future.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audioboom and iTunes, and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.